For thousands of years, the holy lands of the Middle East have run with blood. Here, the scars of battle fought between three of the great religions of the world are etched into the earth. But the deepest wound was made by a war between Christian and Muslim, begun at the close of the 11th century and fought for 200 years. At stake, a tiny strip of land just a few hundred miles long, but with the greatest prize. Jerusalem. Now this holy war has passed into legend. But they were those who saw it with their own eyes. Great chroniclers from two different worlds, Christian and Muslim, who wrote of great deeds, great battles, great warriors, of men who would lay down their lives for their God. This was the collision of two great faiths, a clash between the Crescent and the Cross. This was the Crusades. In 1096, to great fanfare, more than 60,000 Christian warriors set off from Europe on the First Crusade. Their goal was Jerusalem. For more than 400 years, the holy city had been in Muslim control. The Crusaders vowed to reclaim it in the name of Christ.
For Christians, Jerusalem is so important because Jesus died here on the cross and he rose from death. So, the most important point of the history of salvation took place there. So therefore, Jerusalem, for the Christians, is the center of the world.
This Christian army had struggled its way 3,000 miles across the forbidding landscape of the Middle East in a series of epic encounters with the forces of Islam. After 3 years, this, the First Crusade, reached the walls of Jerusalem. Once inside, no one was spared. An estimated 30,000 citizens were slaughtered by the Crusaders. Muslims, Jews, even fellow Christians. But as the Crusaders reveled in victory, slowly, steadily, the Muslims prepared to strike back. Eventually, the wrath of Islam would be unleashed on the fledgling Crusader kingdom. Under one leader, Saladin, and one battle cry, Jihad.
When Jerusalem was taken, during the First Crusade, the killings were horrible. Jews who'd gathered in the temple were burnt. Promises made to Muslims that Muslim women and children would be allowed out free were violated with impunity.
To Muslim eyes, two of their holiest shrines were now defiled. The Crusaders stabled their horses in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and at the Dome of the Rock, where the Prophet Muhammad is said to have ascended to heaven. They tore off the Islamic symbols to reconsecrate the mosque as a church. In the heart of Jerusalem, its gleaming new crucifix boasted to the Muslims that this was now a Christian city.
They were just stunned and shocked by the violence, the brutality, the killings that were inflicted on them, and what shocked them even more, that this was done in the name of Christianity.
Allah. 140 miles to the northeast, in the city of Damascus, thousands of Muslims flocked to the Umayyad Mosque to mourn the loss of Jerusalem.
Imagine the scene here when the news arrived from Jerusalem to the Damascene people that Jerusalem was captured, not only captured, but the Muslims and Christians there, fellow Syrians, were massacred in their thousands. Every little corner was filled by men, by soldiers, taking their turbans off, moaning, weeping, and discussing what should happen.
Though the will of the people to rise up against the Christian invaders was strong, in 1099, the Muslim world was in no position to mount a counterattack. To the most celebrated Islamic chronicler of the age, Ibn al-Athir, the reason was clear. Its leaders were hopelessly divided.
Whilst the Christians were conquering and settling in our territories, the rulers and armies of Islam were fighting amongst themselves. This caused much discord and disunity among the people and weakened their power to fight the Christian enemy.
The culture of Islam was magnificent, and big advances had been made in the sciences and mathematics. Nonetheless, the political institutions of Islam had not succeeded in creating a society which could be stable. And what we saw emerging was strong local rulers and what we can describe as city-states.
Since the death of Muhammad, the Islamic world had been split between two competing doctrines: the Sunni orthodoxy of Baghdad and Aleppo, and their bitter rivals, the Shia, who held power in Cairo. To defeat the Christians, they would need one leader who could unite the strength of the Muslims under the banner of war. This was the greatest fear of the Crusaders, a major Muslim counterattack. William of Tyre was a scholar and Christian archbishop whose chronicles have become the most important record of the life of the Crusaders. Through zealous Christian eyes, he recounted how the Muslims, or Saracens, began their guerrilla campaign against the fledgling Kingdom of Jerusalem.
The entire country surrounding this city was inhabited by infidel Saracens who were cruel enemies to our people. Even within these city walls, there was scarcely a place where one could rest in security. They reduced the realm to such a state of terror that no one dared venture outside the fortifications.
To survive in this hostile environment, the Christians who remained after the First Crusade had to secure their grip on their new kingdom.
After the capture of Jerusalem, many of the Crusaders returned home. There's only maybe 200 or 300 knights left there. Jerusalem must have seemed quite an empty place. I mean, physically, it's quite a big city. What the Crusaders had to do, of course, was to try and hold on to that, trying to consolidate it, and also try and get more people out there. That was the crucial thing.
The Catholic Church appealed for European families to come and settle in Jerusalem. The homes of Muslims, Eastern Christians, and Jews were requisitioned to house the new arrivals.
Recruiting tours went around Western Europe, advertising the idea, much as when Americans were told to sort of go west. This was go east, young man. You're going to get good property, good tax deals. You've got a sort of a sense of adventure. The other thing, of course, you'll be living in Christ's patrimony. There's that extra element to it as well.
Everybody who is faithful to Christ, he has an inclination to go to the place where Jesus lived, where Mary, his mother, lived, the apostles. And also, because Christianity derives from the Jewish roots, also where the prophets lived.
In the aftermath of the First Crusade, Jerusalem blossomed into a thriving spiritual metropolis with a population of around 30,000, about the same size as medieval Paris.
What we have after the First Crusade is a series of nails that are hammered into the fabric of the Holy Land, strong points that the Crusaders have, but they have to be connected. They have to link up these cities that they've taken and consolidate the territory.
Europeans set up new farms, villages, and castles around the captured cities and created four powerful new Crusader states: Edessa, Antioch, Tripoli, and the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Now that the Holy City was Christian, pilgrim visitors from Europe poured into Jerusalem.
Every year, thousands of them flocked here, determined to walk in Christ's footsteps and to worship at the holy places. Like tourists of today, they needed advice on food, drink, where to stay, healthcare, and they also needed a guidebook.
The top attraction in this 12th century guidebook was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Rebuilt by the Crusaders to house the key holy sites under one roof, it was a spiritual tourist complex for thousands of faithful visitors. The guide also included the essential destination for every traveler: the souvenir shop.
Hi, I'd like to buy some souvenirs, please.
Yes, please. What do you want?
Yeah, the holy water actually is what I was most interested in. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, you've got holy water, holy oil, holy incense, holy earth.
Where does the water come from?
The water comes from River Jordan.
Right.
It has been blessed inside the church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Okay.
Do you want anything else? Rosaries, holy oil, holy earth?
No, I think...
with the holy water?
No, that's fine. It's the holy water I was really after.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, sir.
In the back streets of Jerusalem, the pilgrims found not just souvenirs, but also a taste of foreign food.
Pilgrims needed to eat, and this is the notorious street of bad cooking. Fast food for the Middle Ages. Now, it's quite possible, of course, that you're going to get ill, and you're going to need some help. Let's look at the guidebook and see what they have to say about it. Next to the Holy Sepulchre is the hospital, in which a great crowd of sick people is collected. The total of persons at the time when I was present was 2,000. Between night and day, there were sometimes more than 50 corpses carried out. But again and again, there were new people admitted.
On capturing the city, the Crusaders had taken over the Hospital of St. John. Here, Christian pilgrims who fell ill were cared for by the men who took holy vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience. Known as hospitallers, they soon took on a military role to ensure the safe passage of thousands of pilgrims to and from the Holy Lands.
All along the way are bandit bands lying in wait for you, waiting to pounce on you. So much so that a pilgrim in the early 12th century, writing an account of pilgrimage, said that the road from Jaffa to Jerusalem was littered with the bones of dead pilgrims, and that if you were with pilgrims and one of your friends, one of your buddies was killed, don't stop to bury him, because the grave you dig, he said, will be your own.
To offer increased protection to these pilgrims, a second holy order had been established. Combining a monastic way of life with the bearing of arms, this brotherhood believed fighting off the infidel was both an act of charity and a way to salvation. They became known as the Knights Templar, taking their name from their headquarters, the ancient site of the Temple of Solomon. Both of these military orders would quickly become, for the Muslims, the most feared and reviled symbols of the Crusader occupation.
They both become immensely powerful as monastic orders and as political forces in the Crusader states. They're able to do this because both the Hospitallers and the Templars develop military strength. They become the elite fighting troops of the Crusader states, and they're essential to the survival of this world.
To underpin the defense of their new kingdom, the Templars and the Hospitallers oversaw the construction of a chain of castles. The most magnificent was Krak de Chevalier in modern-day Syria. Stark symbols of authority, these castles declared to the Muslims that the Christians were here to stay. But the Muslims dreamed of fighting back against the Crusaders and returning Jerusalem to their faith. An old Arabic word was being uttered once again. The word for struggle, jihad. Through the early 12th century, men across the Muslim world began to talk of rising up under the banner of jihad against the Crusader occupation.
The jihad is the key element in the armory of Muslim ideology. The notion of jihad dated from the time of the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century, so it's something that's integral to the Islamic faith. It's not something that's invented to sort of counter the Crusade. It's there and it's sort of taken off the shelf and deployed against the Crusaders.
Imad al-Din Zengi, a Turk, was the ruler of the city of Mosul, now part of modern-day Iraq. Intelligent and ruthless, Zengi was intent on expanding his empire. He would be the first leader to launch a successful jihad against the despised Christian invaders.
For him, it was essential that he defeat and move them out of the Muslim heartland. To do this, he had to unite Syria under his leadership.
The mighty citadel of Aleppo is one of the oldest Islamic fortress cities in the world. The knights of the First Crusade had never dared to attack it. Like most of the Muslim world at the time, it was an independent city-state with its own ruler. Zengi set his sights on this fortress as his new power base, a springboard to topple the Crusaders. With his military strength growing, he offered to protect Aleppo from the Christians. In 1128, an agreement was reached, and Zengi took control of the city. With Mosul and Aleppo, he now controlled northern Syria.
Before he came to power, we had no one to impose justice, and the presence of the Christians in our land had made the country into a wilderness. And he made it flower again.
It took Zengi nearly 20 years of brutally fighting his fellow Muslims before he finally united northern Syria.
His own secretary described him as a lion, some kind of fierce wild cat. I believe the words that he used to describe him were a raging calamity. Zengi was one of those, fortunately, minority of the human race who seemed to have enjoyed causing pain to his fellow human beings. His own troops followed him in terror, it was said, because if he told them not to step on crops on their route of march, and one of them did, he would have him hanged.
In 1144, Zengi was now at last ready to let loose his ruthlessness on the crusade. 120 miles from his power base in Aleppo was Edessa, one of the Crusader states. And Zengi had just learned of a golden opportunity to recapture this city.
Zengi had always coveted Edessa and looked for a chance to achieve his ambition and take it. Once he heard that the Prince of Edessa was out of the city, it was like a sign from God for him to advance.
Nearly half a century after the foundation of the Crusader states, the Muslims were finally about to strike their first counterblow. Zengi besieged the city with an army of 30,000 men. The few Crusader knights who remained to protect Edessa were taken by surprise and desperately retreated within the walls. For Muslims, this was the long-awaited show of strength. And the great Arab chronicler, Ibn al-Athir, reveled in it.
They battered the walls ceaselessly, and nothing interrupted their monstrous struggle. His troops were as numerous as the stars in the sky, and the fields around the city were filled with them. They say that birds dare not fly near. So absolute was the destruction by the besiegers, and so unwinking their vigilance.
The fortifications were so strong that the only way to get inside Edessa was to bring its walls tumbling down. Zengi brought in expert miners who knew precisely how to attack the wall's foundations.
Going over walls is difficult because you get shot at and all the rest of it. But under the city walls, there was a natural cave system. And his men broke into the cave system and started to pick away at the bottom of the walls.
The Christian settlers in the city desperately tried to defend the tunnel. But they stood little chance against Zengi's powerful assault. His troops set fire to the wooden beams supporting the tunnels. As they burned, the walls above came crashing down.
Tunneling is actually very effective. And very quickly, Zengi's troops broke into the city.
Once inside, the Muslims began to slaughter the Christian inhabitants. Thousands of men and women and children were killed. William of Tyre chronicled the terror of his fellow Christians as they fled to the safety of their citadel, the tower in the heart of the city.
The more prudent of the citizens rushed to the citadel so that they might at least preserve their lives, if only for a short time. At the gate there was such a crush of people trying to enter that because of the press of the crowd, many were suffocated and died miserably.
Edessa was now back in the hands of the Muslims, and Zengi, the hero of the Islamic world. The first phase of the jihad, the struggle against the Christian Empire, was won.
The taking of Edessa marked an important stage in the taking back of Jerusalem, because what it created was the feeling we can do it.
Although Zengi had led his people to victory, he wasn't admired. He remained brutal and feared.
He had told one of his slaves that the next morning the slave would be killed for having offended Zengi in some minor way. And the slave, assuming that his life was over anyway, decided to take Zengi with him that night.
As the mighty Zengi slumbered amidst his proud army, ringed by his braves with their swords, he perished. Neither riches nor power were of use to him.
2 years after the taking of Edessa, the 59-year-old Zengi was murdered in his bed. The hopes of the Islamic world might have died with him, but there was another willing to take up the challenge. His own son, Nur al-Din, a man who would prove to be a very different leader than his father. Nur al-Din was the son of the brutal Turkish warlord Zengi. He was ready to continue his father's battle, and he set out to unite the Muslim world and restore Jerusalem to Islam.
Nur al-Din was a very pious man, you know, did not like too much play, did not like the way in which the caliphs lived in Baghdad with their opulence and their splendor and their dancing girls and their wines, and said, one reason why we have suffered these defeats is because we as a people have become too indulgent. He was highly respected because he never misused his authority and his power.
The Christians saw the rise of this new leader as a serious threat to the Crusader kingdoms. His message was simple and direct: unity and jihad.
Nur al-Din's vision was very straightforward. Our countries have been occupied by the barbarians, and we have to free them. And the only way to free them, they have waged holy war on us, we will wage a holy war against them.
In Europe, word reached the Pope of the fall of Edessa. On December 1st, 1145, Pope Eugenius III was compelled to take drastic action. He called for a second crusade.
The second crusade was an extraordinarily ambitious scheme. It was an idea of extending the borders of Christianity in every single direction. Christians were terribly confident at this time. They looked upon it as a sort of a rerun of the First Crusade. And a lot of the preaching stresses the idea that the Crusaders should live up to the deeds of their fathers.
The call to arms was answered by one of the most powerful men in Europe, King Louis VII of France, and his wealthy wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine.
The First Crusade had been led by nobles, counts. Here, the King of France, King Louis VII, took the cross. This was, of course, quite a sort of radical move, the idea of a king leaving his lands for 2 or 3 years, having probably a sort of 1 in 3 chance of dying. It's a dangerous thing.
King Louis had a deep Christian faith and was determined to honor the exploits of the first crusaders by retaking Edessa and then expanding the crusader kingdoms. But he was a man of very little military experience and not a natural leader. In May 1147, he set off on the Second Crusade, leading an army of more than 30,000. At the heart of his fighting force were 300 highly skilled Knights Templar. It took Louis' Crusader army nearly 5 months to cross Europe, from France to Asia Minor. The journey took them through the rugged landscape of central Turkey, along this still intact Roman road.
The logistical problems of the Second Crusade were pretty frightening because they decided to move inland through the mountains of southeast Anatolia, through this kind of terrain, in winter. Now, that's a very bad time of the year to be moving. Very little food in the countryside. We know that they were almost entirely dependent on what they could carry. Many of the roads they were on high mountains like these in the background, narrow terraces, animals are falling off, men desperate to keep the food.
But logistical problems weren't the only challenges the Crusaders faced. The route took them through Turkish land, where they were in constant fear of attack by the local Muslim forces.
You got to think, although this is mountainous terrain, there's plenty of open land. Over here, the Turks would be hovering, ready to pounce on any sign of weakness. The strength of the army lies in its compact, tight formation.
By now it was winter, and harsh weather conditions caused the Crusaders to lose their tight formation. The heavily armed vanguard became separated from the main body, and the slow wagon train led by Louis and Eleanor was left behind and exposed. It was just the opportunity the Turks needed. Christian historian William of Tyre interpreted what happened next as a punishment from God.
In battle array, they fell upon our forces. It was fought at close quarters with the sword and brought death and destruction to the Christians. In punishment for our sins, the infidel conquered. An army was reduced to a very few. That day, the glorious reputation of the Franks was lost.
Louis and Eleanor escaped, but thousands of crusaders were killed. To restore discipline, the humiliated Louis surrendered control of the march to the Templars. The battered crusader army staggered on to take refuge in Antioch, a city they had taken on the First Crusade. There, faced with a diminished force of 20,000 men and the growing strength of Nur al-Din, Louis abandoned the campaign to retake Edessa in the north and instead looked south to Damascus, a city much closer to Jerusalem. Nur al-Din also had designs on this independent Muslim city. The question was, who was going to take it first? In 1148, Louis made the first move.
The attack on Damascus can be seen as a preemptive strike against Nur al-Din. He ruled Aleppo. If he was to take Damascus to the south, it would be the first time a Muslim had governed these two key cities. The whole eastern flank of the Crusader states would be governed by one single man with growing power, growing wealth, and a great, great threat.
While in the past, Damascus had been an ally of the Crusaders, it had recently become hostile.
The people of Damascus got really terrified because no one else before came that close to the city walls. The Damascene, simply like any other inhabitants, trying to defend their homes, trying to defend their families, trying to defend their habitats, their livelihood.
The Damascenes could have called on the ruler of Aleppo, Nur al-Din, to rescue them. But that would mean surrendering their independence. They were determined to defend their city themselves.
They were really defending Islam against the Crusaders, against the Frankish army. And they were really looking to die, to go to heaven, according to their beliefs.
If there was one man who embodied their spirit of defiance, it was 71-year-old lawyer Al Findalawi. His story has become part of the folklore of Damascus. His tale is still told today by storytellers in the city cafes.
The Crusaders believed in their evil hearts they could take Damascus. 50,000 infantry and cavalry marched on our city, and the Muslims challenged them to fight. In an orchard by the walls, the battle began. Al-Findalawi, the old lawyer, was determined to fight the infidel. So he went into battle, striking down Christians in the orchard like a man possessed. He said, "I have offered myself for sale, and God has bought me." But through the night, the townspeople became demoralized by the horror of the fighting. After a fierce struggle, the Crusaders overwhelmed the Muslims and closed in on the city walls, closer than any army in ancient or modern times.
رأى الفندلاوي بالمنام. Hello.
Al-Findalawi continued to fight bravely and refused to withdraw in obedience to God Almighty. But alas, he fell in battle, a martyr for the faith.
For days, the battle raged in the orchard surrounding the city, and thousands of Muslims lost their lives. The proudly independent Damascenes now had little choice. They sent word to Nur al-Din, pleading for him to send his army. It was just the news Nur al-Din had been waiting for. But it left Louis with a crucial decision: to stay and fight a growing Muslim opposition, or to retreat.
If they withdrew from Damascus, they felt they would be shamed. If they stayed and fought, they might be defeated. So what they actually did was the worst of all worlds. They shifted their siege from one side of the city to the other, and then decided they had to retreat anyway. This was military incompetence.
Louis returned home to Europe, shamed and defeated. After so much hope, expense, and suffering, his second crusade had ended in disaster. Not only had he turned his back on the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem, he had strengthened the resolve of the Muslims. For Christians, the consequences were calamitous.
They abandoned the siege and returned home. As a result, fewer people undertook this pilgrimage thereafter. From this day on, the conditions for the Latins in the East declined.
When the Second Crusade failed, the Muslim world was hugely, hugely relieved. Their God had blessed them with this divine victory. Also, of course, they were terribly confident. I mean, the last time the Franks had come over in huge numbers, the First Crusade, they defeated the Muslims. Now kings had come over from Western Europe and had not succeeded. This meant the Westerners were not invincible. Muslims could succeed and could, perhaps, in the end, throw the Christians out.
The failure of the Second Crusade was just what Nur al-Din needed to win over Damascus. Through intimidation and charm, he entreated them to unite with him. Only as one, he preached, could they have the strength to overtake all the Crusader states. The Damascenes finally succumbed to his relentless campaign. In April 1154, they invited him to enter the city.
People rejoiced at the prospects of good times ahead. Rich and poor, peasant and artisan, they all offered their prayers to grant the emir a longer life and victory over the Christians.
They were throwing rice, petals, flowers, people really shouting, hurrahing him and praising his courage, and really they were happy.
Nur al-Din was the first to try and give the Arabs a feeling that we are one people and that if we get together, we can actually do it.
For the first time, the two powerful, wealthy cities of Muslim Syria were united under the same ruler, a man focused on the jihad whose objective was one day to drive the Crusaders out.
The entire eastern flank of the Crusader kingdom was now in Nur al-Din's control. He was tightening the noose and now began the final phase of his master plan, to surround the Christians entirely by taking control of a rich and powerful land to the south, Egypt. By 1160, the goal of the Muslims, now united under Nur al-Din, was to encircle the Crusader kingdom. He already ruled Syria. Now he wanted to take command of Egypt and its independent capital, Cairo.
Cairo was like a beautiful bride with an impotent husband, waiting to be taken, and absolutely necessary in Nur al-Din's eyes if there was any chance of defeating the Crusaders. And there was also a big worry on the part of Nur al-Din that if we don't take it, the Crusaders might.
The Crusaders also coveted Cairo. Egypt was a rich and strategically positioned country. And in the early 1160s, it was up for grabs. Egypt wanted to remain independent. It was the stronghold of the Shia branch of Islam and was just as determined to resist Nur al-Din's Sunni Orthodox Muslims as the Christians. But in 1168, the Christians made a fatal mistake and handed Nur al-Din a great advantage. The Crusaders perpetrated a brutal massacre of Shia Muslims in an Egyptian town near Cairo.
If the Crusaders have acted differently, they would have taken Cairo with the greatest of ease, for the city notables were ready to surrender it. But when they heard of the massacres perpetrated by the Christians, they decided to resist. The Egyptians were left with little choice but to plead with Nur al-Din for help.
Nur al-Din was only too eager to help. He sent in his most talented and ambitious young general to help the Egyptians defend Cairo. His name was Saladin. To the Muslim world, Saladin is a legend. His heroic reputation was carefully crafted by one man, his close friend and confidant, Baha al-Din.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah وأشهد أن محمد
Baha al-Din was close to and a great admirer of Saladin.
Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. I bore witness to the genuineness of the rare stories told about the noble hero Saladin.
Like a medieval spin doctor, he put a gloss on the great deeds of his master.
One could swear that from the time he set out, he did not spend one silver coin except on a jihad.
Saladin shared his master Nur al-Din's ambition to control both Syria and Egypt and drive out the Crusaders, but under his own leadership. And that meant taking on Nur al-Din himself. His first step was to assume command of all of Egypt from the Shia rulers, by any means necessary.
The fact that some people who were in Saladin's way, in his path to power, conveniently died at appropriate moments has led other people to suggest at the time and since that Saladin had something to do with those convenient demises. That's impossible to prove. People did die with distressing regularity.
By the end of 1169, with all his rivals conveniently out of the way, Saladin was now the unchallenged ruler of Egypt, controlling as much territory as his mentor, Nur al-Din.
Nur al-Din used to call Saladin the ambitious. Definitely, Nur al-Din wanted to punish Saladin for his treason.
5 years later, before he could cut his young lieutenant down to size, Nur al-Din died. Under mysterious circumstances. He was 57. Saladin rushed from Cairo to Nur al-Din's fortress stronghold, Aleppo. But a successor had already been announced. The son of Nur al-Din was the new ruler of Syria, al-Salih. He was just 12. But young as he was, al-Salih was no pushover. He refused to allow Saladin to enter the city and forced his army to camp outside the gates of Aleppo. The young leader then took his boldest step. He called on the services of a group of religious fundamentalist hitmen to eliminate his rival. Their name has gone down in history. The Assassins.
The word assassin is derived from hashishin. And hashish, we all know, is marijuana. And the story was that the only way they could be worked up to go and kill someone was by drugging them out of their skulls.
The assassins tracked Saladin down to his tent outside the city walls.
Eli! Eli!
They got through his guards, killing one of them. Saladin was lucky to escape with only a flesh wound.
The assassination of Saladin would have been a tremendous blow to the cause. And when the assassin actually got into his tent, it must have created total panic. You can just imagine it.
A year passed before Saladin returned, determined to capture Aleppo. This time he was taking no chances. He ringed his quarters with guards and even scattered chalk dust and cinders around the tent to detect footprints. Still, despite the security, the assassin struck again in a curious and disturbing way. By his pillow, they left a present, some pastries, and with them a death note warning Saladin to retreat, or next time they would succeed in assassinating him. Saladin fled Aleppo again. It was 7 years before Saladin's fortunes changed. In 1181, his rival, Al-Salih, now 19 years old, died. Like his father and grandfather before him, another victim to die in uncertain circumstances.
I have no problems in believing that Saladin was ruthless. What's the problem? I mean, in order to survive in that world, you had to be. Whether he was responsible for the killing of Nur al-Din's son, one doesn't know.
Syria and Egypt now belong to Saladin. 80 years of Muslim disunity were over.
Now he has encircled the Crusader states. He is threatening to strangle them into oblivion. And I think what we can see happening as far as the Crusaders are concerned is a real heightening of the temperature, a heightening of the level of threat, and an awareness that really things are moving inexorably towards some kind of serious confrontation.
Having fought and bullied the Muslim world into a coalition, Saladin would now have to deliver a knockout blow against the Christians of the Holy Land. By 1183, Saladin was at last ready to strike against the Christians and claim Jerusalem. The ambition of the greatest Muslim leader in the century hung like a cloud over the Crusaders as they prepared to do battle for their kingdom.
Any rise in Saladin's power was a cause for suspicion in our eyes. He was a man wise in counsel and valiant in war. So we had great reason to fear that when Saladin had increased his empire twofold, he would rise against the kingdom with greater force and harass us more violently than ever.
While the Muslims were unified, the Christians in Jerusalem were at their weakest. They were led by Baldwin IV, a king who from an early age had been crippled by disease.
He was playing one day, and as playful boys do, they began to pinch each other's arms. The other boys gave evidence of pain. But Baldwin felt nothing. As he began to reach years of maturity, it became apparent that he was suffering from the terrible disease of leprosy. Impossible to refrain from tears when speaking of this great misfortune. Day by day, his condition grew worse.
Baldwin became so ill, it was clear he could no longer rule his kingdom. In the autumn of 1183, from his sickbed, he appointed his brother-in-law, Guy of Lusignan, as regent of the realm. Many thought Guy too weak to rule, but he was determined to prove his leadership by taking on the might of Saladin. He would be helped by an ally at court, a brutal prince with a deep hatred of Saladin, Reynald of Châtillon. It was Reynald who would trigger the long-awaited war. For four decades, Christians had respected the rights of Muslims to pass through their territory on trade routes between Egypt and Syria. But in January 1187, Reynald broke the truce. He launched an unprovoked attack on a richly laden Muslim caravan. He took the noblemen and women prisoner and plundered their possessions.
He seized it treacherously, taking the booty, animals, and the weapons. He threw all the travelers in dungeons, maltreating and torturing them. When they reminded him of the truce, he replied, "Tell your Muhammad to release you."
When news of this attack was brought to Saladin, he said, "This is unacceptable, killing unarmed pilgrims on their way to worship, and whatever else I do or don't do, this is one head I must have."
Reynald's brutal attack gave Saladin his excuse for war. He gathered a formidable army, drawn from every corner of his empire. With 20,000 foot soldiers and over 10,000 cavalry, he marched towards Hattin, near the shores of Lake Galilee.
Till that point that army was created, Saladin was viewed essentially as an important leader, but one amongst many, who had basically been fighting his own side in order to achieve this unity. The first big chance for him to show what this army he had created was capable of doing was at the Battle of Hattin.
In June 1187, the forces that Saladin had gathered began to assemble in this broad plain down behind me here. We can imagine streams of Muslim horsemen and foot soldiers coming in from Iraq, from Syria, from Egypt.
Saladin had thrown down the gauntlet, and Guy had to respond. He assembled the entire Christian force from castles and cities across the kingdom. 1,300 knights, including Templars and Hospitallers, and 15,000 foot soldiers.
14 miles in that direction, behind that modern settlement and over the hills, was Safaria, the base where the Frankish army gathered.
As their standard, they carried the most prized holy relic, the true cross. They believed it would protect them from defeat and ensure victory. Today, many Catholics still believe in the power of holy relics.
Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus.
In a tranquil monastery in Jerusalem, protected in a gold reliquary, lies a fragment of what is said to be the true cross.
The very little piece of wood in form of a cross is a part of the real cross on which Jesus was crucified. The cross is so precious to us. Can imagine? We should not consider relics as magic objects. If we are protected by a relic, this is because God protects us, or His holy angels protect us.
Believing God was on their side, Guy, Reynald, and the Christian army were ready to face Saladin.
On July the 3rd, the Franks set out from their camp at Safaria in good order. Initially, the march went reasonably well, but as the day wore on, it got hotter and hotter and hotter.
With no water in the desert plains, the heavily armored Christian army suffered from severe dehydration.
In the heat of the day, the Franks were struggling intensely. They began to slowly lose cohesion, they began to lose formation. Like an enormous train slowly running out of momentum, going up a long, long hill, they ground to a halt. They were there on an open place, no water, hardly anything to eat.
Then, like an oasis in the distance, the Christians spotted Lake Galilee, a chance at last to quench their thirst. Saladin's biographer, Baha al-Din, revealed how that day his master laid a trap for the Christians.
The Christians, surrounding themselves with infantry, tried to fight their way towards the lake in the hope of reaching water. But Saladin realized their objective and planted himself and his army in the way.
Saladin and his men now stood between the Crusader army and the lake. Guy of Lusignan had no option. In a desperate bid to reach the water, he ordered a charge on Saladin's men. Crusader knights were no match for Saladin's highly disciplined army. Charge after charge was repelled by the Muslims. And at the end of the day, Saladin still had another trick up his sleeve.
In the summer, this place is a tinderbox. This stuff's incredibly dry. Saladin compounded the Crusaders' thirst by setting fire to it, and the smoke was driven onto the Crusaders by the wind and made their throats even drier.
The Muslim soldiers piled on the misery, creating a terrible constant noise. Drums, cymbals, chanting, to inflict fear and foreboding on the Crusader army.
It must have been an awful experience to be stuck out in the open, knowing that really the following day you were likely to meet your death.
On the morning of July 4th, the Christians who remained prepared to make a final stand.
The foot soldiers saw here the horns of Hattin, an old Iron Age fort where they thought they could be safe. They marched up this ascent here, and here in the crater was set up the red tent of King Guy of Lusignan. You can imagine here in this crater very evocative scenes. The few remaining 100 horsemen twirling around, trying to get themselves organized.
Chronicles record that the sacred gold reliquary holding the precious relic of the True Cross was hustled into Guy's red tent for safety. As the exhausted Christians began to collapse, the disciplined Muslim army closed in for the kill. Sensing victory, Saladin commanded his troops to capture Guy, Reynold, and the red tent.
I was at the Sultan's side when we saw the Franks retreating before the Muslim onslaught. And I cried out for joy. "We have conquered them." The Sultan turned to me and said, "Be quiet. We will not have beaten them until the tent falls."
As he spoke, the tent fell.
The relic of the True Cross was seized. Saladin's victory over the Crusaders seemed to be complete. July 1187, the Battle of Hattin was over. Saladin had defeated the Crusader army. Finally, he was face to face with his sworn enemy, Reynold. Saladin wanted revenge for the brutal attack on the Muslim caravan.
He had given orders for both Prince Reynald and the King of the Franks, Guy, to be brought before him. The king complained of thirst, so the Sultan had a glass of rose water brought for him, from which he drank. And then he passed it on to Reynald. The Sultan cried out at the king, "This godless man did not have my permission to drink and will not save his life that way." And with one hand, "Cut off," Reynald said.
Guy assumed he would be next.
Saladin assured him very peacefully, very gently, that kings, he said, literally, kings do not kill kings. And Reynold was an evil man, and he deserved to be killed because of his evil deeds. And that was really the exception and not the norm.
But there was no mercy for the Hospitallers and the Templars, the finest knights of the Crusader states, dedicated to fighting the forces of Islam.
The Sultan chose to put them to death, to kill them all without exception.
It was partially the decision of Saladin to impose some shock and awe. "These, you say, are your best warriors. There, they exist no longer."
Losing the Battle of Hattin was a catastrophe for the Crusader states in the Holy Land.
Guy and the King of Jerusalem had lost almost everything. They had stripped almost every castle, almost every city of its defenders. They had, as it were, gathered up all their dice in their hand and thrown it, and they had all turned up wrong.
The Christian army had been annihilated, and the king of Jerusalem was now a prisoner of Saladin. Saladin's dream was finally realized.
I think it's true to say that Hattin is a key victory for Saladin, and that he's aware that this is a moment in history in which he's going to be able to make his mark in Islam.
Saladin could justify all the years of struggle to bring his people together. He had delivered the crushing victory they so desired.
They drank the cup of fate, and the spears courted them. The horses' hooves massed dust clouds for them. Merged together by the thunder of neighing horses, with the lightning of polished swords flashing alongside them. This was a hard day for the unbelievers. God decreed the victory of our faith.
The captured gold reliquary containing the fragment of the true cross was paraded through the streets of Damascus, a final insult to the Christians. In fact, the Christian defeat had been foretold 2 years earlier by their official chronicler, William of Tyre.
Wearied by the sad disasters which are occurring in the kingdom so frequently, indeed, almost continually, I have resolved to abandon the pen and commit to the silence of the tomb the chronicle of events which we had undertaken to write for posterity.
Saladin swept through the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem. Acre, Caesarea, and Jaffa all quickly fell. In October 1187, the Muslim army reached the greatest prize of all, Jerusalem. They set up camp outside the walls and prepared to lay siege to the city.
The defenders begged for mercy. At first, Saladin wasn't minded to grant the Christians this. He wanted to slaughter them in the way that the Crusaders had killed the Muslims back in 1099.
Inside Jerusalem, the Christians knew they stood no chance in a siege against Saladin and his mighty army. So they played a clever psychological game. If Saladin attacked the city, they threatened to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of Islam's most sacred sites.
Saladin thought about this. He decided to take a prudent line of action. He would spare the Christians if they paid a ransom. This was agreed, and Saladin entered the holy city, his goal, his target, in peace.
For our Lord Saladin, this was a great victory. A great victory.
The reason he is hero worshipped in the Arab world is that he was the one who took back Jerusalem, made it an open city once again for believers of the book, and transformed the fortunes of that world.
Jerusalem was in Muslim hands again, and it had been taken peacefully, unlike the Crusader occupation 88 years earlier. But the Muslims showed their contempt for the Christians in symbolic ways.
When Saladin's victorious troops entered Jerusalem in October 1187, one of the first things they did was to tear the cross off the Dome of the Rock and have that cross dragged through the streets of Jerusalem, kicked, abused, spat on.
The Crusader kingdoms were crushed. The fall of Jerusalem sent shockwaves through the Christian world. But not for long. Almost immediately, there would be a call for a third crusade. the shocking news of the Crusaders' defeat at Hattin in 1187, and especially the loss of Jerusalem, reverberated throughout the West. Almost immediately, Pope Gregory VIII made an emotional appeal for a third crusade.
Anyone of sane mind who does not weep would seem to have forgotten not only his Christian faith, but even his very humanity. With those savage barbarians thirsting after Christian blood and using all their force to profane the holy places and banish the worship of God from the land.
The difference for the Third Crusade as opposed to the Second is that now Western Europe has a very clear goal. It's very clear what this crusade is going to be about. It's going to be about getting Jerusalem back. And the kind of shockwaves that went through Western Europe after Hattin and after the loss of Jerusalem were immense.
Europe's most powerful leaders rallied to reclaim the holy city of Jerusalem once and for all. In May 1189, the first army of 100,000 men left Germany, led by Emperor Frederick Barbarossa.
Emperor Frederick Barbarossa was the Holy Roman Emperor, the most powerful man in Western Europe. He'd been on the throne for over 40 years by this time. He was a veteran from the Second Crusade, one of the few men still living at the time of the Third Crusade. His authority was enormous. Saladin was terrified. He knew that this was the strongest card that the Christians had to play.
But Barbarossa drowned in a freak accident crossing a river on the way to Jerusalem. Most of his vast army lost heart and turned for home. This left the newly crowned King of England at the head of the largest Crusader army, the 33-year-old Richard I.
In our mind, we think of him as one of the greatest kings of England, one of the mythical kings of the English past. In reality, he probably thought of himself far more as what we might think of today as a Frenchman, because his key lands were in what we'd now think of as France, and the Angevin Empire, which held England and large parts of the continent, stretched throughout what we'd now think of as the French world.
Richard I was the son of Eleanor of Aquitaine, and already an experienced general. He'd spent most of his life fighting in Europe, and knew that success in battle required a full war chest.
He's very aware that crusading costs money, and that if he wants to prosecute a successful crusade and he wants to achieve his goals, he's got to have the financial backing necessary. To do this, he's prepared to literally take money anywhere he can get it.
A new tax called the Saladin Tithe had been levied to finance this third crusade. In addition, Richard sold everything he owned, castles, towns, and lordships, to ensure he could buy the very best military hardware. It was said he would have sold London if he could have. He was determined not to repeat the fiasco of the Second Crusade. His was to be the best organized and most highly equipped campaign ever. After 14 months of preparation, Richard set off to the Holy Land on the Third Crusade. Meanwhile, confident in his power, Saladin decided to release his prisoner, Guy of Lusignan. He believed the deposed Christian king was no longer a threat.
The Sultan had undertaken to release King Guy. He stipulated that the king should not draw sword against him ever again, and he would be his servant forever. But the king broke faith, and God cursed him.
But Guy, breaking his pledge to Saladin, gathered his remaining forces and set out to redeem himself and rebuild his kingdom.
He was a man who'd been humiliated. He was shamed in the eyes of Christendom. He was the man who'd lost the holy city of Jerusalem. In order to get his reputation back, he had to do something spectacular. And he settled upon a very, very bold idea indeed. Here we see the city of Acre. It was the most important port in the Levant. It could be the base of a new wealthy kingdom. He was a king without a kingdom. He needed to start somewhere.
The fortified port of Acre had fallen to Saladin's forces soon after the loss of Jerusalem. Now, with his army of 400 knights and 7,000 foot soldiers, Guy was determined to take it back.
We can actually see some of the area that he attacked here, looking at this map. We have down here the Tower of Flies, which you can see out there in the harbour, and stretched along there are the sea walls. And this really is the medieval city that Guy had chosen to besiege. He set his troops up in a ring around here, and that was where he entrenched his men and dug in.
The Muslims inside Acre bombarded Guy's army with stones, rocks, even body parts. Word of the siege got back to Saladin, and his army charged down the coast to help defend the city. With Saladin's forces in place, Guy and his besieging army couldn't break through. Over two punishing years, Muslims and Christians fought an on-and-off battle over Acre. Guy knew that to break the deadlock, he would need help, and it would come. Richard I and his army of 17,000 were on the way. In June 1191, after months of meticulous preparation and a year-long journey, Richard I of England and his 17,000-strong army arrived in Acre.
The accursed king of England arrived. His coming had a great ceremony, for he was a mighty warrior of great courage. And his coming had a dread and frightening effect on the heart of the Muslims.
Richard and his men were an instant source of inspiration to the weary Christian army. Richard seized control of the battle, and within weeks, he broke the deadlock.
He came with the cutting edge of Western military technology. He had enormous siege engines, which he was able to bring with him. These things were almost individual characters to the Crusaders. They had names like God's Own Catapult and Bad Neighbour, and they struck the fear of God into their Muslim opponents.
Siege engines brought in pieces and then reassembled in the east allowed the Crusaders to intensify their bombardment of Acre and to get right up to the wall. The chronicles reveal how Saladin managed to counterattack these huge towers. A Syrian soldier offered Saladin a recipe for Greek fire, a kind of medieval napalm. Made from crude oil and sticky wood resin, it was devastating, burning to a cinder anything or anyone in its path.
This is actually very difficult stuff to make, and the key component is naphtha, because naphtha provides sticky fire. That is fire which will not merely splash all over something, that's not too difficult, but will stick to it and hold and set it afire.
Volley after volley of Greek fire rained onto the Crusader army. Suddenly, Richard was on the defensive as all three of his giant siege towers went up in flames.
The blazing meteors of Greek fire hit their targets. They were consumed in flames.
Deprived of his great war machines, Richard desperately needed a new strategy. He offered his soldiers 4 gold coins for every stone they could remove from the base of one of the towers.
What he did was to put so much effort onto one particular point that a breach in the wall was created. There was a gaping hole through which the Crusaders would be able to enter the city.
After 5 weeks of fighting, Richard's troops broke through the walls of Acre, capturing the city and taking 2,700 of Saladin's men hostage. The unimpeded rise of Saladin had been brought to a halt. Baha al-Din witnessed the impact of this defeat on the Muslim leader.
I came into Saladin's prisons. It was like a parent bereft of a child. I offered him what comfort I could and exhorted him to think of his duty to Palestine and Jerusalem, and to save the Muslims left in the city.
Acre was a great victory for the Crusaders and for Richard. His courage in battle gained him fame throughout the Christian world, and with it, a new name, Richard the Lionheart. The Third Crusade could now advance to Jerusalem to recapture the Holy City. But first, Richard had to deal with the thousands of hostages. He issued an ultimatum to Saladin. The men would be released in return for a ransom of 200,000 gold pieces and the return of the relic of the True Cross.
Negotiations dragged on, and Richard the Lionheart had begun to conclude, probably correctly, that Saladin was using those hostages as a way to drag out the negotiations and wear down the Franks. Richard became increasingly frustrated. And eventually he did something that some people have considered a war crime and that he was criticized for at the time.
Richard's actions that day at Acre have gone down in history as one of the most ruthless episodes throughout all the Crusades.
The enemy brought out the prisoners for whom God had decreed martyrdom. With the sword, they killed them in cool blood.
The massacre of the Muslim prisoners that were taken in Acre is still talked about. It was a very brutal episode. Richard was totally brutal, in my opinion.
Richard took such drastic action because he believed he had no alternative. And in the coldest, most stark military terms, it's true. These men were a drain on him. He had to feed them, he had to look after them, he had to guard them. He was hardly going to release them. They'd come and attack him again. So what he did was to try to resolve the situation quickly and effectively. It was a terribly brutal thing to do, but it enabled him to carry on his momentum, to begin to march south and to fulfill his mission of recapturing the Holy City.
The triumphant Crusader force of 12,000 men left Acre in August 1191 and marched south toward their final goal, Jerusalem. Saladin had to stop Richard the Lionheart's march south toward Jerusalem. If not, he risked losing the Holy City and his grip on the Muslim world.
When the Crusaders left Acre, they were in super confident mood. They were convinced that they would be able to defeat the Muslims. They set out in a very, very particular formation. Inland were the foot soldiers with their vital role of protecting the heavy cavalry. The cavalry themselves were lined up with the Templars at the front and the Hospitallers at the back, the strongest men to protect the most vulnerable parts of the march. Then, between the cavalry and the sea, came the baggage train, the weakest, the slowest, the most difficult bit to defend. Then finally, out to sea there, came the Crusader fleet, essential to keep the army supplied. This was a textbook march.
The Third Crusade had become a war of wills between two great men, Richard and Saladin. Both were warriors, diplomats, and strategists of the highest order. Saladin was determined to draw the Crusaders into battle. He bombarded them constantly, but Richard was unstoppable.
And what he demonstrates in this period is enormous charisma as a military leader and enormous discipline. He shows himself to be able to keep his troops marching, even as they're being peppered by arrows. We hear about people having 10 arrows sticking out of them and still staying in formation, still marching. This completely wrecks Saladin's plan to pick off the Crusaders as they're making this march. And it's this discipline that shows Richard was a true military genius.
Richard's army survived the onslaught by Saladin and reached the Crusader town of Jaffa in September 1191. A month later, he left the coast and rode inland towards Jerusalem. Richard was now tantalizingly close to the Holy City. But then he made a monumental and startling decision that shocked his army to the core and has been debated by historians ever since.
It was 45 miles from Jaffa to Jerusalem, yet Richard stopped a few miles short of the Holy City. He'd come to realize that if the Crusaders captured it, they would not be able to hold on to it. The masses in the army were furious. They'd come to free the Holy City. They couldn't countenance not attacking it. Richard overruled them, turned them round, and went back to the coast.
Richard feared his depleted force of 12,000 men couldn't hope to take the Holy City and defend it against Saladin's vast army drawn from across the Muslim world. He had failed in the primary mission of the Third Crusade, to recapture Jerusalem.
Deep in his heart and deep in his motivation, I think, was a real desire to march on Jerusalem and to take this holy city. That was what the Crusade was all about. But at the same time, he was also a general and he was a king. And so he knew that military sense told him Jerusalem could not be taken, he didn't have the resources, and the very best, it couldn't be held even if he managed to take it through some miracle.
In the spring of 1192, Richard returned to Acre, the coastal town captured 8 months earlier. He decided to consolidate the cities he had taken along the coast, leaving the door open for a future crusade. But his decision handed the initiative back to his arch-rival Saladin. No longer forced to protect Jerusalem, Saladin launched a lightning attack on the coastal town of Jaffa, next to modern-day Tel Aviv.
Here at Jaffa, Saladin tried to break the Christian stranglehold on the coast. He sent a group of men in, and they besieged the city. Very quickly, they got in, and only the citadel resisted. The garrison was desperate. They sent an appeal up to Richard, who was way up the coast at Acre.
Richard reacted immediately. He gathered a tiny force of only 55 knights and crossbowmen and sailed down the coast to Jaffa. On the beach just in front of the town, Richard would display his inspired military leadership. The Crusaders were staring defeat in the face. But showing immense personal bravery, Richard was beginning to turn the battle around as Saladin looked on.
Both these men developed a healthy and real respect for one another in the course of this expedition. I think Saladin knew that Richard was a real military force to be reckoned with. And I think Richard knew that Saladin was almost unique in the Muslim world in the fact that he'd created this unified empire.
Saladin's admiration for the Crusader king grew as he watched Richard drive the Muslim forces off the beach and into the town. The battle was fought street by street as the Christians tried to take Jaffa back from Saladin's troops. During the battle, a volley of arrows brought down Richard's horse. Seeing the king vulnerable and exposed, Saladin ordered his men to send him a replacement. As the battle wore on, both sides were overcome by exhaustion and fatigue. But ultimately, Richard's highly disciplined and organized army proved too much for Saladin's men, and they retreated. By September 1192, the two armies had fought each other to a standstill. Saladin faced increasing discontent from his Muslim allies.
He was no longer sure that he could maintain this level of armed struggle and armed warfare indefinitely. The reason for that was that his soldiers were from the lands. They had not come from abroad. They had not been paid. They were not going to follow their leaders till kingdom come. These were people who came from neighboring villages or who came from the towns, who had families, who had property, who had lands they had to tend to, and they did not like being away from that permanently.
Saladin decided the best option was to make a truce with Richard the Lionheart. It was agreed the Christians would keep the coastline towns from Jaffa to Tyre, but Jerusalem would remain in Muslim hands. As a concession, Christian pilgrims would be allowed to enter Jerusalem to worship at the Holy Sepulchre. Richard the Lionheart himself never set foot in the Holy City. He refused to enter Jerusalem as long as it was in the hands of his enemy. In October 1192, Richard left for Europe. Saladin received an envoy from his arch-rival, pledging he would return to wrest the whole territory of Jerusalem back once he had raised more money and men. Through messengers, Saladin sent his reply. If the land were to be lost, he would rather it be taken into Richard's mighty power than into the hands of any other prince. Just 6 months later, in March 1193, Saladin was dead at the age of 56, worn out by more than 5 years of relentless marching, sieges, and battle. His loyal friend Baha al-Din recalled the sad day.
He arrived when he was already dead and transported to God's favor and the seat of his grace. The citadel, the city, the world was overwhelmed by such a sense of loss as God alone could comprehend. Each man's grief, sorrows, tears and cries for help kept him from looking at anyone else.
بارك الله في خليفته ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن
I think Saladin's legacy was that he was the man who captured back Jerusalem. Capturing it really fulfilled many aspirations among the Muslims of the Middle East.
But for Richard the Lionheart, there was bitter irony in Saladin's death so soon after he left the Holy Land.
Had Richard stayed just over that one last winter, his chief enemy would have gone. The Muslim world fragmented. There was a real succession struggle after Saladin's death. Richard would have been perfectly placed to exploit that.
Richard the Lionheart never returned to the Holy Land. He died in 1199 from an arrow wound he received while fighting in Europe. Crusades would be periodically launched over the next 100 years, but the enthusiasm for reclaiming the Holy Land eventually began to wane.
Really, this movement only achieves one victory, only has one success, and that's the First Crusade. The reality, of course, is that the Crusades never really managed to dominate Islam in the course of the 12th and 13th century, and that really throughout that period they're fighting a losing battle. They're trying desperately to hold on or to retake, and they never achieve full victory.
In 1291, the last Christian outpost, Acre, fell to the Muslims. The 200-year Crusader military occupation of the Holy Land was over, but the psychological scars remained.
The Crusades had a very deep impact on Arab society. They were seen as a barbarian incursion, and stories of those Crusades are still told in cafes and in families as if they happened yesterday. And so whenever the West has invaded that region again, people say it's another Crusade.
After their victory in the First Crusade, the Christians struggled desperately to keep hold of the Holy Land. Yet in the end, Saladin's capture of Jerusalem in 1187 was the death knell to the Christian cause. The Crusades saw the collision of two civilizations, each fighting for the Holy Land. Each believing God was on their side. The blood spilled on both sides redefined relations between Christians and Muslims forever. That epic clash almost 1,000 years ago of two ideals, crusade and jihad, still casts its shadow to this day.